This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks, guys. Get more from and about each episode of The Blotter Presents, plus book reviews, fantasy casting, updates, and much more by signing up for the Best Evidence newsletter at blotterpresents.substack.com. And now, the show.
No case ever ends for the Federal Bureau of Investigation until it is solved and closed with the conviction of the guilty or the acquittal of the innocent.
I'm holding two pair of true crime properties this week. The Most Wanted section contemplates investigation discoveries and Oxygen's takes on the death of Rebecca Zahow. In the Cold Case section, I honor the sacrifice of my office DVR this Memorial Day by clearing off two 2018 episodes of American Experience on a 1920 Wall Street bombing and the Massey affair that consumed 1930s Hawaii and the nation. Many were watched, few were chosen. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 98. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, trying to find the true crime that's worth your time. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I am alone at the wheel today, so with three cases across about 6 hours of programming, I'd better get after it. One case and two different takes today. The first is Rebecca Zahow, an ID murder mystery that aired, as you're listening to this, a couple days ago on Investigation Discovery. And Death at the Mansion, Rebecca Zahow, airing on Oxygen this coming Saturday, June 1st at 6 p.m. Links to both will be in the show notes. First, the case file from Wikipedia. Rebecca Zahow was discovered dead at the Spreckles Mansion in Coronado, California, where she lived with her millionaire boyfriend, pharmaceutical CEO Jonah Shacknai. Zahow's death occurred 2 days after Shacknai's 6-year-old son, Max, took a fatal fall from a staircase banister in the same beachfront mansion. San Diego Sheriff Bill Gore announced on September 2, 2011, that Zahow's death was a suicide while the younger Shacknai's was an accident, and that neither was the result of foul play. Members of Zahow's family disputed the finding that her death was suicide and filed a $10 million wrongful death lawsuit against Jonah Shacknai's brother, Adam. The jury in that civil trial found Adam Shacknai responsible for Zahow's death, end quote. What Wikipedia does not mention, at least in this section, is the manner in which Zahow was found, specifically hanging from a balcony, functionally hog-tied with red nautical rope, and gagged with a t-shirt, but otherwise naked. Adam Shacknai was the one who found her, and while much of the evidence that might have linked him to her death was circumstantial, the idea that she would have taken her life in this way defies common sense, not to mention Zahow's family's understanding of her. There's a lot of other evidentiary information here that may or may not be relevant, but here's the problem with this case as the topic of properties like this. In order to, quote, sell it as a viewing prospect, you have to locate people with the case, remind them of the relevant details. Once you've done that, though, you've done that, and there may not be much left that the audience can't find by Googling. So then your show is left with florid reenactments, a few, at least in the case of Investigation Discovery's version, sinking to the level of offensive, the same 4 to 6 photos of the players involved, gassy talking heads with, among others, the omnipresent and self-seriously blinky Diane Diamond, and, quote, exclusive details like this one.
Unprompted, Adam offers one final tidbit about the morning of Rebecca's death.
During the polygraph exam, Adam volunteers that he was pleasuring himself to pornography that morning just before discovering the body. That just comes out of the blue, and everybody thought I think it was really odd.
After 2 hours of questioning, the examiner shares the results.
You could have done a whole lot worse on the test. Could have done a whole lot better, too. But based on what I've got here, we're kind of in an inconclusive range, which really doesn't bother me that much.
He couldn't tell one way or the other whether Adam was lying or not when he's asked if he had anything to do with Rebecca's death.
Cool? This is the problem, though. There's been no substantive movement on the case, no new information since the settlement. There's only the highly unusual, highly sordid, highly tragic facts of it. And I'm not judging the networks for trying to leverage that for eyeballs. This is a business. What I'm saying is that as an entertainment package, it's almost inevitably going to present as rather static and dull. The ID version certainly does. That is, until the final minutes.
In his closing statement, attorney Keith Greer stuns the courtroom with a realistic mannequin of Rebecca Zahau hanging from a red rope.
It does look very lifelike. I was mentally prepared for it, but boy, it was hard because that really hits the reality of what really happened to her.
That's Zahau's sister. This visual is shared with us. We are not prepared for it. It is terrifying. And the editing lingers on the courtroom footage of this basically trussed-up sex doll hanging from what looks like the undercarriage of gymnasium bleachers. This is really not what we mean by centering the victim, guys, at all. Oxygen's version, called Death at the Mansion, couldn't help but show well by comparison, and this is a more considered take on the case. It's packaged as a limited series, and it staffed up its on-camera investigation team with former prosecutor Lonnie Combs, true crime show staple Billy Jensen, and America's investigator Paul Holes. But it's showing the same half-dozen photos of Zahau and a lot of the same commentary from Zahau's sister, right down to the phrasings, along with the kind of introductory self-congratulations so many of these shows seem to encourage the on-camera talent to indulge in.
I'm Lonnie Combs, and I was a criminal prosecutor in Los Angeles County for 18 years. As a criminal prosecutor, I had a motto: ever vigilant, never forget. I am their one shot to get their story told. I would always have a picture of the victim on the wall. And today, the picture I'm focusing on is Rebecca Zahau.
Before I say anything else, I will apologize for mispronouncing your name, Ms. Combs, but here's the thing. Thanks for taking the case seriously and speaking for the victim, but this is exactly zero information. It's not like Combs was going to shrug, "This is kind of a who cares her, but the check cleared, so let's get this over with," right? I mean, come on. Death at the Mansion does dig itself out of that hole pretty quickly. In the same sequence, Combs goes on to talk about the way that Zahau herself seems to disappear from her own story.
She came over to this country. She was very focused on her career. She was a fitness buff. She was a career woman. She spoke six languages. You never heard any of that. It was just the beautiful. And if she wasn't beautiful, they probably would have barely talked about her at all.
Certainly that's true of ID's special, which glibly lists the interests Zahau and Shaq and I had in common as basically fitness and being family-oriented, which, if you're going to go that broad, why not just add had chins and enjoyed breathing to the list? But this, too, is slightly on the self-satisfied side. After all, the show isn't about Zahau's life either, is it? It's about her death, and you don't get to position that as the most interesting thing about her and then lament that everyone else is positioning that as the most interesting thing about her. And I will add here also that, not for nothing, but even if it were the most interesting thing about Zahau, who cares? Some people just are. They go to work, they go to the gym, they go home, they watch TV and don't have any particularly hot takes on it. And they were loved. Workaday lives that were taken too soon were still taken too soon and still deserve justice. And I wish the TV crime news mags were better or good at all about making that clear without patting themselves on the back for it or thinking a bunch of gauzy B-roll of their siblings walking pensively in parks is the same as getting to know the victim. Anyway, I should step off Death in the Mansion's dick for this, because it's far better than most of its ilk. And despite some meaningless evidence analysis, the, quote, investigation of the knots in the rope has no expert basis and is ergo meaningless, and the attempt to tie in BDSM practices, ostensibly to, quote, rule them out as a factor, felt like pandering, It does get Sahau's sister to be more forthcoming about her issues with Sahau's relationship with Jonah Shacknai, whom she accuses of using her sister as, quote, a glorified nanny. And while you might think you know everything there is to know about the telltale forensic signs of strangulation because you've seen the entire series run of Law and Order, that is not shade. I include myself in that judgment. Paul Holes might still have something to teach you.
So the hyoid bone, this is a floating bone in the neck that oftentimes is diagnostic for manual strangulation. Because it floats, when you have a narrow thing such as a ligature, it's able to move out of the way from the forces of a ligature being applied. But when you have broad hands wrapping around the neck, the hyoid can't slip away, and that's when it gets fractured.
At this point in the investigation, evidence is pointing both ways. But if Paul's right, it's going to be way more likely that somebody strangled Rebecca and then used the hanging to sort of cover it up.
I'm not sure why the production had to ruin the moment with that profoundly trashy sound effect. Did you guys hear that? I'm not going to run the clip again, but like if you go back, if you use your like back 10 seconds button, listen for those squishy sounds. No, guys, no. It still got my attention, though, as did Death at the Mansion overall in ways that ID's take on the case did not. But I can't really recommend either of these for the reasons that I mentioned up top. Coombs says that they're going to take, quote, whatever they come up with to the San Diego sheriff, but really, there's still the same lack of momentum here that there is in the other one, but the Oxygen version is okay. If you stan Jensen or Holes, there's worse stuff out there. It's just a highly inefficient sit, and the issue is the case. If you watched either of these, or plan to, let me know what you thought. And of course, Best Evidence will try to do a little more digging. You can subscribe there once again at blotterpresents.substack.com. Let's see if there was anything more interesting in my DVR archives. As we're tackling two season 30 episodes of American Experience today, episode 4, The Bombing of Wall Street, and episode 5, The Island Murder. And again, you will find the links to both of those in the show notes. Here's the case file for episode 4. Just after noon on September 16, 1920, 100 pounds of dynamite and 500 pounds of cast iron sash weights, that's those little thingies used to counterbalance windows, the old kind with the chains, exploded at the corner of Wall and Broad Streets in New York's financial district, which coincidentally is roughly where I was standing when Tower 2 began to come down 80-odd years later on 9/11. In any case, the blast killed nearly 40 people outright, seriously injured dozens more, and total injuries numbered in the hundreds. Although conventional wisdom seems to agree that the bomb was the work of Gallianists, Italian pro-worker anarchists, and so-called revolutionaries by deed, the case was never solved. And a bombing that meant to strike at the heart of capitalism killed not the robber barons and CEOs, but clerks and brokers. As is so often true with American Experience episodes that in title deal with single individual crimes, episode 4, The Bombing of Wall Street, is really about the context around, or even that created, those acts. In this case, that the United States coming out of the First World War was in a boom time, but mostly for the plutocrats who'd profited off the war, was suffering a post-war spasm of resentment about the sedition and espionage acts that had curtailed free speech, and was struggling with where to put the line between prosecuting the country's security and protecting the rights of individuals. And if that sounds familiar, it should.
It's easy to think about terrorism as this frightening plague of the early 21st century. The Wall Street bombing suggests it actually has a much longer and deeper history. How widespread government surveillance ought to be. What kinds of policies are justified in containing a threat? Those questions were being openly asked in 1920.
This is quite an efficient account of this period of anti-capitalist uprising, the Palmer Raids, and the beginning of the ascent of the compulsive file keeper and grudge holder J. Edgar Hoover, a 24-year-old law clerk who was put in charge of the so-called Radical Division of the Bureau of Investigation. I wouldn't have put 24-year-old me in charge of going to the corner for a Coca-Cola, so perhaps it's not surprising that Hoover's, quote, political surveillance filing system and theatrical deportation raids caused more problems than they solved, harassed innocent people, and failed to make the U.S. safer or turn up the actual culprits. The bombing of Wall Street is narrated with burnt umber seriousness by Oliver Platt and draws the parallels between now and then with the series' customary gentleness.
You've taken people whose opinions you don't like, who have joined organizations that you don't like, and you've arrested them en masse without ever having a court proceeding. Are these people really a threat or are they not a threat? And how are we going to assess that? You get a really big set of questions about what kind of country do we actually want to be?
Indeed. But in order to raise and address these questions, perhaps within a broadcast hour, perhaps for other reasons, there is no mention of Sacco and Vanzetti. Not a passing mention, not a glancing reference, no mention, nada nunca. Given that the bombing those two alleged Gallianists were accused of committing had taken place not 6 months before, the omission is striking. But the more I think about it, the more I think that it's the only sensible editorial decision to be made here. The writer and director of the episode, Susan Bellows, also made JFK Parts 1 and 2 for American Experience. And that topic, if no other, is going to make you extremely comfortable extremely quickly with just leaving huge chunks of decades and policy on the cutting room floor, lest you turn into Joe Gould. Here's the thing, though. My next sentence was going to assert, without remembering specifically having watched it, that the American Experience episode on Sacco and Vanzetti doubtless covers this subject in more than adequate depth and detail, only to find after a quick Google that there somehow is not been an American Experience episode on Sacco and Vanzetti. So one wonders if this Gallianist bombing were not perhaps selected as a somewhat smaller and more manageable representative of federal law enforcement's inability to deal effectively with the rash of revolutionary, quote, actions at this time, and more generally with the dissatisfaction of America's have-nots by any means other than crushing them under a boot heel. In any event, I hope that a Sacco and Vanzetti American Experience is in the works. In the meantime, this one's available via the PBS app, and it's a visually compelling sit that will probably send you in search of deeper dives at the library. Our next episode, episode 5 of the 30th season, The Island Murder, definitely sent me in search of deeper dives, but not in a good way. I believe that this one originally aired in 2005 under the title The Massey Affair, and here is the case file. Thalia Massey, the 20-year-old wife of a naval officer stationed in Waikiki, stormed out of an officer's dance. Thalia engaged in that sort of dramatics often enough that her husband Tommy didn't even bother following her, but between the dance and her home, she claimed to have been assaulted and robbed, although initially she did not mention having been raped, by a group of Hawaiian men. The so-called investigation that followed had little chance of resulting in justice.
There was a real strong sense of racism coming at us from the military. They were almost entirely Haole young men, and a lot of them were Southern. So they had this idea that Hawaiians shouldn't be out and about, having a government, having a good time in Honolulu.
Dark-skinned men frolicking in public with white women was too much for many soldiers and sailors. And the military men knew when they were being made fun of by the beach crowd at Waikiki. But locals didn't push too far. There were simply too many servicemen for safety.
The men settled upon for blame by the Haole power structure in Hawaii 1931 may have done something, but it's unclear what they did to Thalia, and a jury declined to convict. While prosecutors scrambled to find, or more properly speaking, fabricate, additional evidence before a second trial, Thalia's mother, Grace Fortescue, always referred to as highborn in accounts of this case, although she was fully trash, swanned into town to put a stop to the rumors that if anything had happened to her drama queen daughter, she'd had it coming.
Where Thalia was involved, maintaining the family reputation had always been a chore for Grace. Her eldest daughter was ungovernable, hungry for attention, and lacking in discretion. Earlier that summer, Thalia had unburdened herself to a University of Hawaii psychologist who was making a study of sex and marriage.
He gave her a battery of tests. They asked for you to write out your thoughts in longhand. Thalia poured out her thoughts about her hateful marriage, gave them to the psychologist. He filed them, and then he counseled her. Two counseling sessions. He then called her husband, Tommy, and said, "This is beyond my competence. She needs serious psychiatric help, and I really urge you to get it."
We'll return to the idea that Thalia was Betty Drapered by her husband and doctor shortly. First, let's finish summarizing the actual case, which entered true legendary territory when Fortescue, Tommy Massey, and a couple other hench howlies rounded up the usual suspects. One of the suspects was shot and killed. The howlies went on trial and were sentenced to 10 years for manslaughter, and the governor of Hawaii promptly commuted their sentences to a single hour while, it's rumored, toasting their victory with champagne in his office. The Masseys divorced a couple years later. Thalia tried to take her own life around that time, only the first attempt in a long, sad line culminating in a fatal 1963 overdose. And while the island murders is fairly solid on the part of the narrative that summarizes rapaciously shitty colonizing behavior in the Kingdom of Hawaii at the turn of the last century, I did not know, for instance, that the Pineapple King, Sanford Dole, functionally overthrew the Queen and then talked the United States government into annexing the islands. It is awfully flip about Thalia herself. Received wisdom was, and apparently mostly still is, that Thalia made it up to get attention. But which it are we even talking about here? First of all, I don't think anyone argues that she wasn't beaten up, so the episode's snotty dismissal of her story and her in their entirety does not go down well, at least for me.
The quiet whisper of the initial lie grew to a clangorous din of power, politics, and racism. An ugly noise that resounded through this placid-looking tropical community, and then to the marbled echo chambers of the White House, the War Department, and the United States Senate. The story of the Navy wife and her alleged assailants jumped from the local Hawaiian newspapers to front pages across the United States, fetching the attention of President Herbert Hoover, media baron William Randolph Hearst, and the country's first celebrity attorney, Clarence Darrow.
Leaving aside the crazy overwriting happening right here, I just don't think you're going to get this undercurrent of lying bitches, am I right, in a more recent production. I should hope not. Nor, I hope, are you getting this attitude towards Thalia's evident mental illness.
In the days after the divorce, Thalia began what would become a long series of suicide attempts. She finally succeeded in 1963.
I kind of feel for narrator Blair Brown here. She's got that perfect, grand, area-appropriate locution for the topic. But as a result, when the writing sells Thalia out, which it seriously never misses an opportunity to do, Brown's plummy rendering of the narration's snotty conclusions is even more maddening. The Massey affair is about racism, colonial injustice, the purchase price of acquittals, and also about a young woman constrained by the time and circumstances of her birth and infamy from getting the treatment she probably needed or having the quieter, more satisfying life she should have enjoyed. Her mother was a gangster and not in a good way, but Thalia didn't really get any justice either. And I'd looked forward particularly to the island murder as having some, or any, insight into that. As it is, I have to say this one's a skip. Instead, I'd like to read you a few words from Bill James's Popular Crime as he's wrapping up his section on the Massey case. The Van Slingerland he refers to here is Peter, author of a 1966 book on the case called Something Terrible Has Happened. Quote, Van Slingerland makes constant references to the, quote, alleged rape, and there is a lengthy discussion about the lack of, quote, evidence of an actual rape. Well, no one questions that this very attractive young woman was abducted off the streets in the middle of the night. There were witnesses. And there is no question that when she turned up an hour or so later, she had cuts and bruises, torn clothes, and a broken jaw. She said she had been raped. What's your theory? Contents of her purse, broken, were recovered from the place where she said she had been taken. So the doctors failed to do an appropriate medical examination. So what? People now write about Thalia Massey as if she was a manipulative bitch who was probably making the whole thing up. She wasn't, and this seems to me inappropriate. End quote. It's certainly possible that Howley law enforcement suggested to Thalia at some point that she claim a sexual assault in order to make their vigilante approach to prosecuting the offenders seem justified. It's also possible that Thalia was reluctant to be forthcoming about having gotten raped because it's hard to talk about and would have been even harder in 1931. And it's absolutely possible that she assumed she wouldn't be believed. And what do you know? She wasn't believed or believed in by anyone her entire life. Coming up on The Blotter Presents, When They See Us on Netflix, 16 Shots on Showtime, and an Errol Marisode with Kevin Smogler. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, find me on social media. Blotter Presents on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can become an official Blotter tipster at The Blotter's Patreon page, that's patreon.com/blotterpresents, and subscribe to that newsletter, blotterpresents.substack.com. Do you like the podcast? Tell a friend. Rate it on iTunes. Help other people find it. Not like the podcast? Don't tell anyone. Thanks so much for listening to The Blotter Presents. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.